While we were down in class today, I was looking at the old pictures of this building, and I don't know if you've ever looked at that down there, but when it was first built, the speaker was not elevated. He was actually below everybody else. I think that's kind of interesting. I hadn't realized that, but have a look at the old picture from the 1800s that's down there. Well, we're certainly glad to be here today, on again, off again, and on again, so I'm glad all you were able to make it as well today. The last time that I was here, we talked about disciples, and we talked about the fact that the disciples were probably a larger group of people than we might have thought. I mean, when we say disciples, we often think about 12 particular men that spend time with Jesus. But this whole series that I'm trying to do, I'm trying to look at Jesus' relationships with the people and traditions of his time and what they can teach us about how do we interact with our 21st century world. And how can we learn from the way that he interacted to be better ambassadors for him? We still fall into this category of disciples. A disciple is a learner. A disciple is one who emulates their master. But along with that, we carry the honor and the responsibility of reflecting our Lord to this world. So it's important that we continue to be close to him and to draw nearer to him. And last time we talked about three phases of engagement: inquiring, conversion, and transformation. Inquirers, I said, are people who've seen good things, and they're hungry for more. They're looking for more answers. And so when Jesus came on the scene, there were lots of people like that, that wanted to know more. And maybe that's something that we need to keep close to our hearts, that we need to keep that zeal, that fire for learning more. But at some point, the inquirer has to go through a conversion. They have to change because somehow what they've been hearing now becomes truth for them. They see truth in what Jesus has to offer. And at that point, their hearts are melted and they realize that they need him in a much deeper way. And finally, the transformed. The transformed, which is where I hope that we all are at this point, we're now letting Christ rule in our lives. We're willing to give up our own driving force and let him drive. We've given over our selfishness to selflessness, to let him rule in our lives. And that's what we are as disciples. We constantly need to remind ourselves that transformation is an ongoing thing, that we don't get there overnight. It's a process, and perhaps something that we're guilty of is expecting immediate results and not allowing the Spirit to continually work in our lives to change us and move us forward. Well, that's where taking a look at these 12 particular men that we often think of as the, quote, disciples, where that can help us. These were, to quote John MacArthur, ordinary men. They had the same faults, the same warts that we have. And yet Jesus was able to use them and mold them and change them in such a way that he was going to send them out, knowing that his time was short, to carry on his work. If you turn to today's reading in the book of Mark, and appreciate Andrew's working on that that word, Boanerges, which is a tough word. If you look at this passage beginning in Mark chapter 3 and verse 13, it says, Jesus went up on a mountainside and called to him those he wanted, and they came to him. He appointed 12 that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach and to have authority to drive out demons. Jesus particularly selected these men. He knew that his time on earth was short. He was not going to be around. He needed to leave it in the hands of someone who could take care of it. It says in other versions a couple of things that we don't get from Mark's version. Luke records for us that this was such a monumentous occasion that Jesus went out to pray, and he prayed all night before selecting these men. We also learn in a couple of the others that where we see he sent them out to preach in this translation, some of the others, Jesus calls them apostles. Now that's a word that we kind of have trouble with. He gives them this special title of apostles, but prior to this time, that word didn't have the churchy connotations that it does today. It simply means one who is sent. So Jesus has selected these men for a very particular work. They're going to have a special role in continuing to spread his good news once he's no longer able to do that. If we're looking back at them now, we'd probably call them the founding members of the church. And what a choice Jesus makes. If a company today is trying to choose somebody to lead, they'll look for the people with power and sway, the well-spoken, the influential, and the promising. Is that what Jesus did? His first choice were a bunch of fishermen. It looks like two families, Peter and Andrew, who seemed to have hired hands to help them, so they were doing all right, and James and John, who couldn't get along well enough. They seemed to be in separate boats. To this, he adds a few more people. Matthew. He's a hated tax collector. He owned a franchise, but it's not donuts that he's offering. He did the dirty work of collecting from the Jews the taxes for the Romans. And this wasn't any kind of H&R Block who helps you out by doing your taxes for you. This is more like one of those check cashing services where they charge exorbitant prices for people who are already hurting, for the people who are most desperate and living paycheck to paycheck. That was the kind of reputation that these guys had. The others we don't know very much about. They were likely laborers like Jesus, but as John MacArthur says, they were 12 ordinary men. For me, that resounds, though, because I'm like them. I'm an ordinary guy. It gives me cause to be thankful. Jesus can work with anyone in any conditions, and we shouldn't beat ourselves up about not being worthy of his calling. Just as he did with these men, he can take us and make us into what he needs. Simon, he's called a zealot for his right-wing nationalistic beliefs. Some people say that Philip might have been the Eeyore of the group who could find the clouds on any sunny day. But here's the really remarkable part. God selected these men with all their shortcomings and their foibles and was able to make them into pillars of this coming church. You don't have to be well-read. You don't have to be Mensa material. You don't have to be good-looking. You don't have to be an athlete. What you have to be is ready to give up your self-centered goals and be prepared to take on his goals. To show you just how far off base these guys could get, I want to take a look at a couple of passages. Mark chapter 9, beginning in verse 33. Jesus has just finished telling them that he is going to have to sacrifice himself. It's actually the second time he's told them, because they don't always get it. Beginning in verse 33 of Mark chapter 9. They came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the road?" But they kept quiet because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. I think he knew exactly what they were arguing about, and they knew it too. They couldn't talk about it. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, "Anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and the servant of all." That's a pretty hard message. That's a pretty good take from Jesus on exactly what was wrong with their thinking. And as if that isn't enough, Mark comes around to it again in the very next chapter, chapter 10. Once again, Jesus has just finished telling them he's going to have to die. He's being serious about the threats that are all around them, and they don't seem to get it. Mark chapter 10, beginning verse 36. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right hand and the other at your left in your glory." "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" "We can," they answered. Now about this time, I'm expecting Jesus to put them in their place. "Really? Thunder boys, you don't have a clue what's going to happen. I've told you 3 times now and you still don't get it. You're so far out in left field, you can't even see the plate." But that's not what he says. That's what I'd say. But that's not what he says. Jesus says, "You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with. But to sit at my right or my left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." Wow. Jesus, Lord of heaven and earth, says, "That's not for me to choose. That's for my Father." And he doesn't chastise them. He knows that they're going to undergo their own trials at a later time. And he recognizes how immature they are. That's a ridiculous claim. They can't possibly understand what he's going to go through. And yet, so he demonstrates to them that he too has a master he must honor. And then as if it wasn't bad enough that the two of them were so impertinent that they would ask for this, it apparently was the whole group. Because look what we hear now. It's not just James and John. The rest of them are angry with them for even presuming to ask Jesus to promise a place of honor. In verse 41, when the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be a slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." He doesn't hit back. He just lets them know, "I'm a servant. You need to be a servant too." I can imagine that that was far more powerful than if he'd confronted them. So, what was the mission of these 12? What was it that Jesus particularly wanted them to do? Well, primarily, their mission was to extend his ministry. He knew that his life on earth was short. He would plant the seeds of his ministry, but as Paul said, he needed someone to water the crop. In our passage in Mark today, it says, he appointed 12 that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach and have authority to drive out demons. So you notice there's three things here that he talks about. First of all, that they might be with him. What's the most important thing about appointing these men? That they might spend time with him, that they might be under the master, that they might learn as disciples at his side. After that, it says they could preach. This word, apostle, means one to be sent, so they're sent out with a message. Now, if you think about it, they're probably not Toastmaster material at this point. They're fishermen. They're not good speakers. But once they had a relationship with them, they were ready to encourage others, and he was going to give them the words that they needed. And finally, it says that he would give them authority. Now, in this particular passage, it says to drive out demons. In others, it says over sickness. He was giving them the authority by these proofs. These were works that they could do that would show that they came from God. Casting out demons was a sign of God's authority acting through them. So three things he gave them. First of all, he gave them relationship and a new community with him and God. Secondly, he gave them this mission to go out to others and to speak. And finally, he gave them authority, the authority of God to spread this message. In John chapter 20, we read this. Again, Jesus said, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I am sending you." And then he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive anyone's sins, their sins are forgiven. If you do not forgive them, they are not forgiven." This is his final act of sending them out after his crucifixion and as he appears to them. They're now ready to take this on. And what is it that he says that he's asking them to do? He's sending them out to forgive sins on his behalf. He's sending them out with the Spirit to show people the new life. Jesus, as Lord and Sovereign, summons the 12 into this new community to a mission that is founded in himself. These men had some problems. John MacArthur says, five things that they were lacking. They lacked spiritual understanding. They just didn't get it sometimes. They lacked humility. These two who wanted to have the most important places at his side. They lacked faith. When Jesus said, "How are we going to feed all these people?" They lacked commitment. When the worst things happened, they were scattered, weren't they? And they lacked power. Jesus gave them the Spirit to overcome all of these things. I want to finish up by looking at one passage in a little more detail. It's also from the book of Mark, Mark chapter 10. This is sometimes called the mission chapter. It begins with the beginning of the chapter, and it has the same kind of list that we read from the book of Mark. Jesus sends them out. It says he sends them out with very specific instructions. Don't go to the Gentiles. you're to go to the lost sheep of Israel. So they had a very specific mission. And he says, as you go, preach this message, the kingdom of heaven is near. Did I say Matthew? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. It's Matthew that I'm looking for. It's Matthew. No wonder there were some glazed eyes. I said Mark, but it's Matthew. Chapter 10. I got the chapter right. I just got the wrong book. Sorry. No wonder you're confused. But Luke has it too. Yes, that's correct. I don't know if it's in chapter 10. I think it is. Where were we? Oh, yes. Preach this message. The kingdom of heaven is near. This new community is ready to begin. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse those who have leprosy, drive out demons. This will show your authority. Do not take any gold or silver or copper in your belts. Gold, silver, copper. The copper becomes the smallest amount of money. They're not to rely on what they have. They're to rely on God. Don't take an extra, or don't take a bag. Don't take an extra tunic. Don't take a staff. If you're traveling in that day, it could get cold. You might need an extra coat. If you're traveling in that day, you could run into wild animals. You need a staff. They're going to have to rely on God. And when you go into a village, find some worthy person and stay at his house until you leave. Find someone and stay there. That wasn't the normal thing when people were sent out like this. Normally, they would go and they would move around from house to house so that they could kind of share the responsibility. But he says, no, find someone who's worthy. He's very, it's a very focused exercise that he's asking them. And it goes on and it talks about several different things regarding how awful it will be for those people who won't accept you. But I want to concentrate on the last part, beginning in verse 26. Do not be afraid of them. Who are they not to be afraid of? They're not to be afraid of anyone who fights against them. They've already said terrible things about Jesus. And he says, how much more are they going to do against you? Three times in this section, from 26 to 41, he says, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid, in verse 26. There's nothing concealed that will not be disclosed, or hidden that will not be made known. Anything that happens is going to come to light. All these truths that he's been telling them, he wants them to proclaim from the rooftops because people need to hear it. And in verse 28, do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. These men, they could potentially kill you, but that's not what you really need to worry about. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell. There's a bigger battle here. And finally, he says, are two sparrows sold for that same little copper penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from the will of your Father. Two little sparrows that were the food of the very poorest, God is concerned about. He's going to be concerned about you. Warren Wiersbe says the following. The theme of this last section is discipleship, not sonship. We become children of God through faith in Christ. We are disciples as we faithfully follow him and obey his will. Sonship does not change, but discipleship does as we walk with Christ. There is a great need today for faithful disciples, believers who will learn from Christ and live for him. So they were afraid. There were many things that were going to come to pass. But Wiersbe says, remember, you are children of God already. That's done. Yes, you need to mature. You need to be challenged. You need to grow. Disciples that are not growing are stagnating and are not of any use to Jesus. But Wiersbe says, be confident in the fact that you are already sons and daughters of God. There's a difference between that, between being God's and improving and being better disciples. If we have 12 men who demonstrate that for us, then we have a positive model. We have the assurance that we are already sons and daughters, and we can grow. Think of what these guys became. From arguing about who's going to be greatest, James went on to become the first martyr that the church records in Acts. And his brother John goes on to write a gospel about this time. And then three more books. And he calls himself the disciple whom Jesus loved. Complete change. Or Peter, who denied that he knew Christ, even when they said, you've got that accent. Aren't you from South Africa? No, I think it was Galilee, not South Africa. They knew who he was, and yet he still denied him. And look what he came to do in the second chapter of Acts. So if there's a lesson for us in these 12 men, it's that God can work with anything. Jesus is no respecter of persons. It's out of ordinary people that he finds his greatest glory. And for the 21st century world, that's you and me. Secondly, you have to be ready to be a servant in the same way that Jesus was. He says a disciple is never greater than his master, but if we're sincere and humble, we can be like him. And finally, if the disciples are any kind of example for us, we know they got it wrong. A lot. And Christ had every confidence in them that his Father could work through them and their imperfect human natures to deliver the message to the world. And what speaks better to us than seeing them successful at that? Let's go from this place today, asking God to help continue to send his Spirit to transform us, to be the people that he wants us to be.